Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're on Long Final, Ireland's aviation podcast from Squawk 7000.
Welcome to this special episode of Long Final from Squawk 7000. And the reason we're doing this is because there's a very interesting event happening this Monday evening, the 12th of April. And I'm joined by Alan Phelan and Teddy Fennelly. You're both very welcome along to Squawk 7000. Alan, I'm going to start with you, throw you in the deep end there. What is happening on Monday and why should we make sure we're there?
Yes, on Monday evening, we're hosting a Zoom event to commemorate the first east-to-west transatlantic flight crossing by the Bremen. On board was a very famous Irishman, Colonel James Fitzmaurice, accompanied by two German aviators. This happened on the 12th of April, 1928. And we in Portlaoise have a special place in our hearts for Colonel Fitzmaurice because he wasn't born here, but he spent his formative years here, and he's held, like say, in high regard here in Portlaoise. And over the last number of years, we've tried to commemorate this event annually, and Teddy, who's on the call today, has been deeply involved in the Fitzmaurice story from way back, going back to the 1970s, even for the 50th anniversary. So myself and Teddy have taken up the mantle to keep the Fitzmaurice story alive here in Portlaoise.
And Teddy, you're a newspaper man by profession, so what was your interest and when did you first come across the Colonel?
Well, it was purely accidental, shall we say. I was working with the local newspaper, the Leinster Express, here in Portlaoise. I come from Portlaoise. I had worked in many places before that, but coming back to Portlaoise, I became more aware of things that were happening in the town and had happened in the town. I remember many years back in my youth, many years ago, as you can see. But my father actually went to school with James Fitzmaurice. And he often mentioned that when I was growing up about, in the class and that, not much about the background. I never heard much about the background to Colonel Fitzmaurice when I was growing up, actually, at all. Mm. But when I was reading some article, perhaps back in the 70s, probably an anniversary on the flight, I became interested again in Colonel Fitzmaurice. And I researched his background. And eventually, when I became editor of the paper, of course, I had plenty of time to do research and writing and that. But when you're busy, you often do things, more things than when you're not busy. But
I've heard that phrase, sometimes if you want something done, ask a busy man. Is that it?
Man, exactly. Yeah. Perhaps. But I wrote a book on Colonel James Fitzmaurice. That was in 1997. It was in advance of his 100th birthday. Mm. He had been long dead at that time. I think he died in 1967. But however, the book anyway caused a lot of ripples around, and it brought back Colonel James Fitzmaurice into focus again. And I still think it's a brilliant story, and he was a brilliant man.
Do you know, I'm dying to get into the depth of this particular story because, you know, as you say, growing up and being interested in aviation, you wouldn't know about the man, you wouldn't hear about him. But yet, if you go to Baldonnell, there is a spot there on the apron which commemorates where the aircraft left from. I'm curious to know how come he was almost written out of our aviation history in the first place. What happened?
Well, that is a very good question, and it's a question I didn't answer in my book, actually. But I think that Fitzmaurice alienated certain people and in different ways. When he came back to the country, he learned all his piloting skills, of course, with the RAF, and he came back as a highly qualified pilot, and he became one of the first pilots to join the Irish Air Corps. Right. So that was his background. But he came back, he had served in the British Army, and his British Army experiences was at the front a lot of the time, in the Battle of the Somme and other significant encounters there in the First World War. So he had huge experience, but he came back as an ex-British Army man.
So we're almost talking almost Civil War politics might have impinged on that a little bit there.
We're talking about Civil War politics. When he came back, joined the Irish Air Corps in 1922, it was just probably at the start of the Civil War. Mm. It was just after the foundation of the Irish Free State. And he was blackmailed, actually, because of his background. But And he was brought before a tribunal, and he had to prove himself that he hadn't been involved in things that he was accused of being involved in. But he came out squeaky clean out of the whole thing, and it was a terrible, terrible experience for him. And I have that experience recounted in the book. But in later years, he spent his early teenage years in the British Army. He joined at 17 years of age. He fought at the Battle of the Somme at 18 years of age. He qualified as a pilot in the RAF, which was the RFC at the time, as a 20-year-old. So he to be successful, he knew he had to become one of the boys, shall we say, But he acquired a very, very distinctive Oxford-Cambridge accent, as British officers...
they would have done at the time. It wouldn't have helped him, yeah.
And he... But remember, at the time, it was very customary for even educated Irish people to acquire some sort of an accent, and even on RTE, shall we say, I remember that there was a famous broadcaster. He was sacked because he had such an accent.
Yes. So,
but in any case, Fitzmaurice, if you listen to some of his speeches and that, he had a very distinctive English accent, and this alienated him very, very much so against a lot of the Irish people.
Teddy, I read as well that he said towards the end of his life about the fact that how we in Ireland tend to treat people like that. There's quite an interesting quote from him, I think.
Yeah, well, he has a lot of quotes and a lot of good, very, very good quotes. I think that he was a much better person than he came across. From everything he did was for the good of the country, apart from the good for himself. But I mean that everybody tries to look after themselves, and he had to particularly had a very interesting life from his early days. But he tried to do the best for himself, firstly, but he tried to do the best for his country. And of course, the flight and in other matters, he led his life on the line for his country, shall we say. And shall I also say that when he made the famous flight, as I call it, in 1928, the first East-West transatlantic flight, he was dressed in the Irish Air Corps uniform. Now, Ireland at the time was only 6 years old and is part of the British Empire still. But he was very proud to wear that uniform. And not only did he wear it on the flight, he wore it at every event in America and all the countries he went to afterwards. He carried the Irish tricolour, which was practically unknown at the time, on the flight with him. And the whole New York was decorated when they were celebrating the flight in New York. So it was decorated with Irish tricolours. This was a new country, remember. So, I mean, he, you could say, put Ireland on the map, on the international map.
We have an input from the Air Corps on Monday night with a particular story about the tricolour. Michael, you might be interested to see.
All right, so you're not going to give us any more about that. So we have to watch if we want to see it. Is that what you're saying, Alan?
Yeah.
We'll come back to the flight in a second. I'll come back to you, actually, Alan, on this one, because the actual timeline of where he is and Colonel Fitzmaurice, in the history of aviation in itself, I mean, by the time he's getting himself interested in aviation, it's only a couple of years old since the Wright brothers, even.
Exactly. And like I say, he grew up in Portlaoise in the early 1900s, and he would have come across his interest in aviation through association with a local garage in Portlaoise called the Aldrich Garage, where they actually were constructing an aircraft at the time.
Right.
He was coming home from school one day and he fell into Aldrich's garage and he was amazed at what he saw. And from that moment onwards, he had a huge passion for aviation. It was the same time that Blériot was crossing the English Channel, like you said, a few years just after the Wright brothers. And he actually witnessed the Portlaoise plane, as it was it came to be called, taking off in a meadow in Portlaoise. And that's recounted in his biography, as Teddy will tell you.
Yeah, your chapter, Teddy, I think, is called Aladdin's Cave, isn't that it? Which describes him seeing the actual aircraft for the first time.
Like many old garages at the time. I mean, Aldrus was one of the first in this part of the country. It was opened in 1898. So the motor car was a very new invention at the time. And it was very in its infant stages, even when Fitzmaurice was growing up, as you can imagine. But all the garages at that time, they had so many diverse things to look at and to interest a young boy, and he was very interested. But when he saw this airplane being created, that was very fascinating for him.
I want to spend a bit of time talking about this airplane in a few minutes, but I also want to make sure we cover off the event on Monday as well. And yeah, if you can give us a rough idea, I suppose, of the running order of the evening and what will happen. It starts at 7 o'clock.
Sure, it starts at 7 o'clock and Teddy is going to introduce our speakers. Following that, we're going to have the short presentation from the Air Corps that's coming from Brigadier General Rory O'Connor. And after that, we will have an input from the German ambassador, Her Excellency Mrs. Dijke Postel. So she's going to have an input on the event, obviously, with the German connection with Fitzmaurice and the Bremen. Following that, we have a very interesting input from Liam Byrne, who has, over the years, collected a lot of tributes and memorabilia to do with Fitzmaurice and the Bremen. We are going to have a short presentation from myself and Tim Costello to do with the Portlaoise plane, where it came from, where it's at the moment, and what our plans are. To conclude, we're going to have input from some very eminent visitors from Bremen themselves, who were instrumental in getting the Bremen aircraft back to Bremen from the United States. Finishing off then, we'll have a very interesting music piece. Martin Turish is a very prominent composer in Ireland, and he's been working with Music Generation Laois in composing a symphony celebrating Fitzmaurice's life. And we'll hear Martin's story, and we'll hear a little bit from his composition to conclude the evening's event. Teddy's going to round up along with Michael Parsons, the chairperson of the Heritage Council, and hopefully we'll get it all done in the space of an hour and a half on Monday night. We'll see how it goes.
Two chances of that by the sound of it. Do you know, it's time we talked about the flight itself, because it's referred to as the flight of the Bremen. Bremen was the name of the aircraft in this particular case. And there's a German connection. So, Teddy, will you unpack that one for us? How in the first place was there a flight going from, in this particular case, east to west? Because my memory of it was they were banned for many years. They weren't even allowed because they were so dangerous.
That's right. It was banned in most European countries because there were a number of attempts, and 10 to 12 attempts, and there was a number of fatalities on that, and so people turned against it because the fear that it was too experimental and too dangerous, and a waste of time, a waste of money and a waste of lives. So the Germans were anxious to recover some of their ground they had lost over the losing the First World War, coming out very badly out of it. And there was an attempt there to try and recover their lost glory, shall we say, and especially in the air. So they were anxious to set new records, and the biggest record to be set at that time, the biggest breakthrough, was to cross the Atlantic in the most difficult direction. Well, as you know, Michael, being an aviation man, crossing the Atlantic from the American side is a different proposition. Obviously, the tail winds, and you're going against the prevailing winds. But there are a number of other things as well, especially at a time when technology was so poor and that that the American coastline was very, very hard to make out when you had no modern guide on your plane. And the east to west flight of the Atlantic was the thing that the Germans knew would capture the world imagination in aviation. So they, in the Junkers plant in Dessau, they constructed two planes to do this particular job. One was called the Europa and the other was called the Bremen. In 1927, remember, the Atlantic had been flown the other way around by Alcock and Brown in 1919. So this was 1927, 8 years afterwards. And that was a long time in the history of aviation, which was only, shall we say, 20.
Half skipping a jump, to be fair, yeah.
So I mean, it's a long time. It shows you how difficult it was to go the other way around. And the Germans made an attempt in 1927, but a few hours out in the Atlantic, they met typical Atlantic storms and decided to return, which wasn't the easiest thing for pilots at the time to do. But it was a sensible thing because it saved their lives and it also saved the planes. Well, among on one of the planes, on the Bremen, was Captain Hermann Kohl. And Captain Hermann Kohl was not put off by this at all. He reckoned it could be done, and it could be done in his plane. So he attempted, with the help of Baron von Hunfeld, who bought the Bremen from the Dessau plant, and put it at the disposal of Captain Kohl, and he decided to go along with him. He had some experience, shall we say, in flying, if not the qualifications, but he went along with him anyway, and it worked out pretty well. But the problem was what you mentioned earlier: they couldn't fly from Germany. So they brought the plane to the airport in Berlin, and they wrote out a writ that they were going back to Dessau, flying to Dessau. So they set off for Dessau and ended up in Ireland.
By accident or on purpose?
Why Ireland? Ireland had a few advantages, because Ireland had no such bans on international flights. Furthermore, it saved 9 hours at the time of flying time, which was significant. And remember, this was against the prevailing winds, even from Germany to Ireland. But however, anyway, that they also had linked up earlier through not an ambassador, but a type of an ambassador from Germany who worked with a German firm in Ireland at the time. And they had arranged to meet Colonel Fitzmaurice. And this was arranged a few months earlier. Now, this was probably early in 1928. But the joint forces, anyway, Fitzmaurice was the commanding officer at Baldonnel, so he had the facilities there at his disposal. And the Germans had the plane, and they had a very good flying officer.
What just for a second, talk about the airplane itself, because it was a metal construction, I think, wasn't it?
It was an all steel construction, which was one of the first all steel constructions at the time. It was a monoplane, but it was had only a single engine. So,
Do we know what speed it was able to fly at? And what
it was able to fly at something over 100 miles an hour. But this didn't work out going the other way. That was against the Atlantic winds and against the Atlantic storms then. Sometimes they were going less than 50 miles an hour, and sometimes they were practically at a standstill. and that story is fascinating. That you could write many, many novels about their experiences in the air, because when they took off on the 12th of April in 1928, it was 36 hours later, they reached American soil. Now, on their way, they met many difficulties, such as oil problems, and they were always worried about the one engine. If the one engine cut out, well, that was
you were getting your feet wet, definitely.
As the old joke says, they'll be up there all night.
Yeah, we know that one.
But around Newfoundland, the great banks of Newfoundland, There's problems over compass problems and things like that, and their one main instrument was their compass, and that didn't work properly, and they went the storms drove them off course, and they went 500 miles off course during the black of night in the midst of a storm, and when the storm finished and daylight appeared, Captain Cole had to use his flying senses, of course, he knew exactly that they had gone in an orderly direction. He could see below at this stage, himself and Fitzmaurice could see the great snowy wilderness beneath them, below them. And they turned down and they went down, come down southerly along the American coastline, around the Labrador coastline. And eventually, Fitzmaurice was doing lookout, and he saw what he thought was a lighthouse below. And they came down closer, and they realized, they thought it was a ship that they had seen in below. But they came down closer, and then they saw that it was a lighthouse. So they knew that there was somebody. There must be somebody.
A sense of relief at that stage, definitely.
A sense of relief, because they were 36 and a half hours in the air. They were running out of fuel at this stage. And by God, were they tired. And they came down anyway. They came down on a place called Greenlee Island, which is a little island between Newfoundland and the province of Quebec in Canada.
Mm.
It was still 1,000 miles from their destination, which was New York. But if you add the 500 miles that they went north and the 500 miles they came back, had their compass been working properly, had they been lucky enough with the weather, they would have reached their destination.
Teddy, what was the reaction in Ireland when the news got back? Was there celebration or was there indifference?
There was more a sense of relief than anything else.
Right.
From the people that really were aware of what was happening, such as the people in Baldonnell who had helped with the preparation for the flight, and such as with his family and friends. But eventually it became a worldwide story, and Ireland became part of that worldwide story.
Mm.
And the Irish people became more familiar with what had happened, and were quite proud of that they had taken a significant part through Fitzmaurice in what had taken place. So there were big celebrations when he did come back to Ireland.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Alan, let's bring you back into the story here for a moment, because I'm curious as to how a man like yourself got interested in the man himself at all, in Fitzmaurice.
My background, Michael, is in aircraft jet engine overhaul and maintenance. So I would have started my career with Airmotive Ireland back in the day, and spent 30-odd years working on jet engines in both customer support and commercial in the facility in Ratcool. While I was there in the mid-90s, I should say, Lufthansa took a stake in the company from Aer Lingus. So we had a German connection straight away, and it was at the time Teddy's biography of Fitz came out. And of course, I was, because I was from a Portlaoise man, I knew Teddy from playing golf in Mount Rat back in the day with my father. And the book was of genuine interest to me. And it was in that period, 97, 98, that I got to know the Fitzmaurice story in depth. Can say that it was in my radar, pardon the pun, prior to that, but so one of the directors from Germany was also interested in the story, and I gave him a copy of Teddy's book on his retirement, and his name was actually Cole, believe it or not, as well. And it's from that point onwards that I kind of got more involved with Teddy. We spoke from time to time about it. And then really it kind of kicked off again for the 90th anniversary when I got involved with Teddy to do the celebration in the Dunamace Theatre in Portlaoise. And we got involved then in the Portlaoise Plane project, and we've been constantly in touch since then.
Okay, so we better talk about this Portlaoise plane, because it is a fascinating story. And there's a lovely picture that probably may even appear at your event of the garage, but with the wings in the rafters.
Yeah, that's correct. I think the picture was taken in Aldred's garage in the 1930s. And you can clearly see in the rafters, and you'll see it on Monday night as well, the wings of the plane hanging there. So this is, I'm guessing, like 20 years since it was constructed. And it stayed in those rafters. I think Fitzmaurice came back to Portlaoise in the 1950s. And I think there's a quote on Monday night where he says he had great recollection of seeing it. So this is, you know, this is 40 years afterwards, we're still in the rafters. It stayed there into the 1960s, in the early 1970s, and then it disappeared. Nobody knew where it went to. And that was part of the story with myself and Teddy, was to try and relocate it. There were stories that had gone down to a car museum in Killarney, County Kerry. There was talk that it was scrapped. There was talk that it had gone to the UK to a collector. Yeah, so Teddy was always on the hunt for it, if I'm correct in saying. And there's another Portlaoise man, Joe Rogers, who happened to be on holidays in the south coast of England back in the mid-2000s. And he was doing a tour of an automobile collection in the south coast of England. Lo and behold, he came across the Portlaoise plane in the rafters of a far-flung corner of this particular site. And he wrote an article about it. When we started looking again, myself and Teddy, we came across the article and we made contact with the owners of the museum in the south coast of England and developed from there. Teddy, maybe you can add a bit.
The man who owned the plane at that stage was a private collector and had a huge amount of stuff, especially old motor cars and boats and things and some aviation material as well, but one of them was this plane that was in the rafters. But a collector like that, a private collector, is a collector. He generally doesn't sell things. That's the reason he collects them and keeps them. And I think that his grandfather, it started with his grandfather and his father, and his father actually acquired the plane. But Alan and myself, anyway, of course, we're two very polite Irish gentlemen, you know. And we, shall we say, but he could see that we were genuinely interested in this plane, all right. And I think that we won him over to think that it wasn't really in the right place and nothing was happening there. It would be great to have it back in Ireland. After much deliberation, he didn't actually give it away, I can tell you.
No, I'm quite sure he didn't, if he's a collector. But you have it. That's the important thing.
We decided on a price, and I was very happy with the price. It was a considerable amount of money, but it was worth getting back.
But let's go back to the two lads in the garage in Portlaoise, or Maryborough, as it probably was at the time. Where did they get the plans? Where did they get the idea? And did it fly?
Yeah, so the plans would have come from the Aldred brothers' interest in mechanical items in general. And Louis and Frank Aldred would have read about, obviously, the Wright brothers. They would have read about Blériot. And there is, Teddy, correct me if I'm wrong, a story that they went to Liverpool to an aviation festival and learned a bit about aircraft there. They came back and the Blériot was probably the model they worked off of. It's very similar to the Blériot airplane. So they started constructing very, very skillful craftsmen in wood. They constructed the aircraft from local timber. They also used, and you'll see it in the photographs, some bamboo for the wing structure. And that came from Ballyfin Estate, which is now a famous hotel. It used to be the Patrician College in Ballyfin. So there is a local connection there with the material that was used. The engine was sourced locally as well. Tonge and Taggart constructed the engine casings. Unfortunately, that has disappeared. We're not sure where it went to, but we're constructing a replica as part of the restoration process based on the Wright brothers' model and based on what's described in Teddy's book. So, yeah, local materials, local know-how. The Aldred brothers actually were also involved in mechanical items for Ardna Crusher at the time. So not only in aviation and cars, but they were also involved in power generation. So very, very mechanically minded and engineering minded.
I suppose the equivalent would be people who love their technology now. These were the techies of the time, weren't they?
Well, they also were the first in the country to build a car. They built two cars. This was before Henry Ford came in and built them on a large scale.
Did it fly?
Well, that is the question. And the thing about it is, how do you describe or how do you qualify flying, as we all know that we're into that, like, you know.
It's more the landing than the takeoff I'm worried about,
there is,
yeah.
There is a process, all right, that you have to qualify, and probably it doesn't qualify on all grounds. But
right. But
we can read Fitzmaurice himself, who in his writings was very accurate in what he said. He was very careful with his words in his writings and that. And he does describe how the plane took off, how he'd seen it, and that inspired him, as Alan mentioned earlier, to for his lifelong enthusiasm for aviation. So he saw it actually taking off. It didn't stay too long in the air. We assume that, but we're not claiming anything further than that, except that our most famous aviator saw it take into the air.
That'll do.
And he seemed to be struck with awe at seeing it doing that. So I mean, it got into the air at least anyway.
We know it also landed and ended up in the rafters, Alan.
It landed yeah, in a pretty rough, because he said that it was tangled up when it came down, you know.
Right.
Now, the interesting part of that is that a couple of years back, a student from Queen's University in Belfast contacted us, and he independently had heard about the Portlaoise plane and was doing a final year project on it. And we've kept in touch. He finished his project last year. He actually worked on putting the Portlaoise plane design into a flight simulator up in Queen's University, Belfast. And he was able to reenact the flight of the Portlaoise plane. And you'll hear more about that on Monday night. The centre of gravity was the issue. I think the engine was maybe just a little bit off the centre of gravity, and that may have caused the hard landing, as we call it, when the attempt took place. But he moved the centre of gravity in the flight simulator and made a successful flight. So it's an interesting part of the story too.
So they might have found that out. I'd love to talk a little bit too and give a name check to the people involved in the restoration, because these are no amateurs.
Well, when we brought back the plane to Ireland, we warehoused it in Dublin for a while until we put a plan into operation, shall we say, and we invited various people that would be interested in it to have a look at it and that, and this was amazing, the amount of people with aviation experience that came. They were really fascinated by what they saw. All was there was a shell, And I think Alan will show that what it looked like when it came back.
An expensive shell, yeah, exactly.
but however, anyway, amongst those who came to see it was a man called Brendan O'Donoghue and another called Johnny Malloy. And these two gentlemen were retired from the Irish Air Corps and had been employed by Aer Lingus. But they were engaged, they had been engaged some years before that, in restoring the Uller.
The Uller. I knew the names, yes. Yeah.
So the Uller was the first plane that was used by Aer Lingus. And so they had experience in restoration. And mind you, when we heard that, we were very interested in both Brendan and Johnny. And the first time they saw the plane, they saw what was there, the shell. They couldn't figure it out. Nothing there to for us to work on, you know, really. So when Brendan went back to his home in Enfield, he kept thinking about what he had seen, and something crossed his mind over the tail, and that there was something here to look at. So he came down a second time, and he was absolutely gobsmacked when he started putting things together. Well, after a little bit of, I mean, he didn't need any further encouragement. I think he volunteered that he'd help out whatever way he could. He couldn't guarantee anything. And with the help of Johnny Malloy, Johnny, who had huge experience in that field as well, and the two of them, and they looked at this from A to a Z and every way around, and they decided that, yes, we'll have a go. And that's where it started.
Yeah, and there was two other guys on the team as well, Michael, not to forget them. We had a very, very good engineer from Emo in County Leash called John Harris, who helped with the undercarriage reconstruction. And of course, not to forget our project manager, Tim Costello, who had a great input into the restoration as well. Eamon is another Portlaoise native who you'll see on the presentation on Monday night. And Eamon worked with our friend from Queen's University Belfast to help him understand the plane and get his project off the road.
Alan, where will this end up? Let's roll it to the future. All being well, COVID out of the way, what's the plan?
The plan is to bring it back to Portlaoise on permanent display. We have a temporary home at the moment, kindly donated by Laois County Council, but we are looking for a permanent home. We'd like to bring Fitzmaurice and the Portlaoise Plain together in a display for the public in Laois and for Ireland, and to commemorate not just the Portlaoise Plain, but more importantly, Fitzmaurice and his connection with Portlaoise as well.
Teddy, did you ever get to meet Colonel Fitzmaurice?
No, he was dead before I had an interest really in him.
And if you could, what would you ask him?
Well, funny enough, I never met the man.
Mm.
But I feel that I have been friendly with him since I was very, very young. Such as my interest has been since I got to know about him. But I did get to know his daughter very well. He had one child, daughter, whom he brought to America with his wife, and his daughter went to America during the celebration for the celebrations. Mm. But I met his wife afterwards, and she helped me very much in finding out who Fitz was and what was he really like, and that unfortunately Fitz and his wife broke up not many years after the flight. But still, Patricia felt very close to her father, and she lived in England. Unfortunately, she's dead now, maybe 10 or 15 years, but she was a lovely lady, and she took a huge interest in everything about her father and helped everybody concerned here with the Fitzmaurice projects, including myself for the book. And she came to Ireland a few times, and we entertained in Portlaoise here on perhaps the 70th anniversary of the flight. And we unveiled a lovely bust here, and it's on display in the foyer in Laois County Hall still. We also have a square, which I was involved in myself in its naming, called after Colonel James Fitzmaurice, right in the middle of town.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on Squawk 7000. A reminder again that the event is on this Monday, the 12th of April at 7 o'clock. It's an Eventbrite, I think. Is it, Alan? Is that where people will find it?
It is indeed. There's an Eventbrite link, and there's also a Fitzmaurice Facebook page. We'll be streaming live on Facebook as well as doing the Zoom Eventbrite event. Hope to see you all there for that. And if anybody's interested, we have Portlaoise Plain at gmail.com. We also have a Twitter account, Famous Fitz, Famous Flight. So yeah, there's lots of social media there that you can catch up on the Fitz story, on the Portlaoise story, and like I said, hope to see you all on Monday night.
And we'll put links to all of those that you mentioned there, Alan, in the programme notes for this particular programme as well. Alan Phelan and Teddy Fennelly, thank you so much for joining us on Long Final.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Mike.
And thank you for joining us on this episode of Long Final from squawk7000.ie. If you'd like to hear more, please subscribe and do tell your friends.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.